Good evening, folks, and welcome to the latest episode of the Page Turner Podcast. As always, I'm Kari Cooper, and with me is...
This is Rob Roy McCandless, and we are pleased to introduce our guest today, Karen Dion. Karen is the USA Today and number one international best-selling author of The Marsh King's Daughter, a psychological suspense novel set in Michigan's Upper Peninsula wilderness. Karen has been active in the writing community for over 20 years. She co-founded the online writers community Backspace, organized the Backspace Writers Conferences in New York and the Salt Cay, Bahamas Writers Retreat. Recently, due to the pandemic, Zoom called the Backroom. Karen was a finalist for, are you ready for this? The Crime Writers of North America Dashiell Hammett Prize, a finalist for the Midwest Independent Booksellers Choice Award, was named Best Thrillers of 2017 by the Library Journal, won the 2018 Barry Award for Best Novel, and then a whole acre of other awards. I had to trim it down just to get those in. So, Karen, we are so excited to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. I am so excited to be a guest on your show.
Thank you. One thing I want to point out is that your best-selling novel, The Marsh King's Daughter, was also translated into 25 languages.
Yeah, it's been a really crazy journey for me because this was not the first novel that I had written. It was actually the sixth, and wow, it's my fourth published novel. So after approximately 20 years of having, you know, modest success, all of a sudden, boom, you know, I wrote this book, and the reception for it really around the world has just been astonishing. Yeah, I'm still floating on the ceiling, and it's been a couple of years now.
Well, no doubt about that. I mean, I read that the Marsh King's Daughter had actually been optioned. Somebody had optioned for the film rights.
Yes, yes. And I just got some news today. Of course, I can't share specifics, sadly, but it's super exciting. And it looks like the project is going to go forward because, you know, the pandemic threw a wrinkle in everybody's plans for a while
right
there. So it's starting to look promising again. So I'm pretty excited.
Oh, yeah, I heard that Alicia Vikander.
Yeah, you know, Vikander. The movie business is a funny kind of a thing, I found out. So when the Marsh King's Daughter was first optioned for film, my agent kept saying, don't get excited until they are actually making the movie. And now I understand what he means because even though there was a big splashy announcement all over the internet, if you Google The Marsh King's Daughter movie, yes, you will see that Alicia Vikander is set to star in it.
Yeah.
Well, she dropped off.
Oh, bummer.
A couple of years ago. And another actress was attached for a little while, and she dropped off, and now we have another actress, and that's the one I'm so excited about, but I can't say yet because nobody's made an official announcement. So we have had five directors and three actresses attached to the project over a period of a couple of years. So now I do understand what my agent says, you know, just sit tight and wait to see how it shakes out.
I was just going to say, so you said that this is your sixth book. Is this your sixth book with this agent, or is this a new agent with this book, with The Marsh King's Daughter?
I have been with my literary agent, Jeff Kleinman, for, let's see, I signed in 1999 with him. So we're going on 22 years this February. Isn't that crazy?
That's a long time. That's a nice, long, built-up relationship, though.
It really is. And so, you know, when he was a relatively new agent, when I signed with him, I was a new writer. And over the years, he's become, you know, a really excellent agent. And I like to think I've become a better writer. So, we have a long-term relationship. I honestly can say that he has loved everything I've written. So, you know, that's kind of cool.
Oh, that's the best kind of agent to have, right?
I know.
And you've grown together.
Right.
Hey, Karen, can I ask, how did you meet your agent? How did you, I don't want to say hook up with him, but like, how did you get to him?
You know, it's almost irrelevant because it was so long ago, but, I had written a novel. I decided that I was going to get serious about writing. So I spent about a year writing short stories to kind of get the creative juices flowing. And then I wrote a novel. But I did not know anything about the business or how to get agents, nothing. Mm-hmm. So this was like in 1998. Um, I I wrote the book and it was a first draft, right? So I thought, well, okay, I've written the book. Now I need a literary agent because I'm going to be published with a major publisher. no lack of ambition, but definitely
right.
lack of knowledge, right?
Good for you.
Yeah. So I started querying agents and I was using, you know, like a hard copy book of Jeff Herman's Guide to Literary Agents.
Oh, the best. I still have mine.
Yeah. This was a long time ago. Yep. So it rocked along for about a year. And then I want to say in January of 1999. E-queries were just coming out, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I was looking through the book to do another batch of querying, and I queried 19 agents who said they had, you know, would take an e-query on a Thursday. And I immediately heard back from several of them, and a couple of them wanted the full manuscript. And so I've never forgotten, one of them said, "Dear Ms. Dion, we would be pleased to consider your manuscript, blah, blah, blah." And then Jeff's email said, "Dear Ms. Dion, your novel sounds wonderful." And it went on from there. And I was just like, oh, this guy's cool. So I sent him to it and I sent the manuscript to him in hard copy. That was on a Thursday. The next Monday, I got an email from him saying that he had started reading it right away. And the manuscript was running into some snags. And would I call him the next morning at my convenience? Well, you know, I worried all night because he said snags. Is a snag bigger than a problem? You know, he said snags, plural, more than one. Well, the upshot of it was he liked my writing. He felt I could pull off the book with a rewrite, but the plotting was a mess. And as soon as he told me what he saw in the manuscript, I could see it too. I was just so green. So we worked together. He signed me even though the book wasn't ready. And we worked on that for 3.5 years through 3 complete rewrites before we were both, you know, reached the point where we said we can't do anything more with it. And he sent it on submission and we didn't get a sale. So then I went back to the book that I had been working on during my querying process. And that was my first book. So it actually was 8 years from the time I signed with my agent to the time that we sold a book.
Yeah. You know what? I'm actually glad that you put in the 8 year part because I was like, you wrote a book and then 1 year later signed and were published.
No, sir. Not at all.
Right. Exactly. Like most authors don't get there are those stories, right? There's those Cinderella stories and you're like, oh, how did they do that? But then everybody else, like you and I and Kari, we have to like really dig in and work hard at our manuscript and our querying and you know, work with somebody who knows what they're doing. That's such a good story, though. That's a lot of fun.
That's a lovely story. That's a great story because it really shows that, A, your editor really knows how to pick them because he saw. because you've evolved into like one of the, in my opinion, one of the best suspense writers of our time. I don't know which book we should talk about first, Rob. I kind of want to talk about The Wicked Sister. Do you mind? Does everybody mind?
No, we can talk about Wicked Sister.
That sounds great.
Okay,
new one.
So I have so many things going on with The Wicked Sister. I waited for The Wicked Sister for a long time. I read The Marsh King's Daughter over 2 days, June of 2019. I remember because it was summer. I was supposed to leave the house, but I didn't leave the house because I was busy reading The Marsh King's Daughter. Let's go with The Marsh King's Daughter. I wanted to know just about some of your inspiration. We'll start with your breakout novel. So I don't know. Should we give a quick recap, Rob? The Marsh King's Daughter is about a woman who is the product of a kidnapping victim.
Yeah.
And I loved how the protagonist's internal journey was so complex because she had feelings for her father, even though he was a kidnapper, even though she knew what he had done. How did you manage to pull that off?
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. So The Marsh King's Daughter, it began with, I was sleeping and the opening sentences just popped into my head in the middle of the night. So, you know, truly inspired. The opening sentences of the book are, "If I told you my mother's name, you'd recognize it right away.
Yeah.
My mother was famous, though she never wanted to be.
Yeah.
Hers wasn't the kind of fame anyone would wish for. J.C. Dugard, Amanda Berry, Elizabeth Smart, that kind of thing. though my mother was none of them. Those sentences, just all that much, was just poof in my head. And so I thought to myself, well, this is interesting. So this story, this character is the daughter of a kidnapped victim and the man who took her.
Yeah.
And it sounded like something I'd like to write, but I was too sleepy to get up and write the sentences down. So I repeated them over and over in my head. So I'd remember them in the morning. In the morning I did, fortunately. And guess what? It still looked like a good idea.
Yeah.
So I that morning I wrote up a few paragraphs in the character's voice, just her telling a little bit more about who she was. And I gave the book a setting. I will say this, I almost gave the book an urban setting because I was thinking about the young women in Cleveland who were kidnapped and hidden away basically in plain sight.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was intriguing to me, but I thought, no, maybe that's a little obvious. So I set the book in a cabin on a ridge surrounded by marsh or swamp in Michigan's Upper Peninsula wilderness. And the reason I set the book there is because I lived in the Upper Peninsula for 30 years. beginning in the 1970s, my husband and I moved to the Upper Peninsula with our infant daughter as part of the Back to the Land movement. You guys won't remember, but it was just basically city kids who wanted to feel closer to nature, right? And you know, our goal was to grow our own food and, you know, have sheep and make card wool and, you know, the whole bit. So we moved to the 10 acres that we bought in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And our daughter was 6 weeks old at the time. We lived in a tent that summer while we built our little cabin by hand, and we carried water from a stream and sampled wild foods. So, Kari, you know from having read The Marsh King's Daughter, obviously I drew very heavily on those experiences when I wrote the book.
We were talking about this earlier, and I had said to Rob, you know, how did you like The Marsh King's Daughter? And he was like, yeah, I really loved it. And I said, you know, did you look her up, though? Did you see her? And he said, no, I didn't. I said, well, Rob, she's, you know, she's just this little pleasant looking lady who looks like she could bake a mean chocolate chip cookie. But Rob, she could skin you.
Well, that's what we were wondering. Like, did you actually live there? Because it felt like you had. It felt like you'd been in the UP, and had you done these things? And it's so great to hear that those two things are true. That's a place you'd been, and things that you had done.
Yeah, that's it. And you know, for me, like Helena, she grows up for the first 12 years. She lives with her mother and father in this cabin, and she never sees another human during all that time, which sounds grim, but she loves her life, as you know. You know, it's the only life she's known, and she loves the whole hunting, fishing, and foraging thing. So for me, my husband and I would say we only dabbled in living off the land because we still, you know, got our meat at a grocery store and so forth.
But that was my next question.
But to write The Marsh King's Daughter, this family lives off the grid. So they do hunt and fish, which I've never touched a gun. So I had to research those parts pretty heavily.
Because in the Wicked Sister as well, it's very based on that. Like you have such an deep knowledge then.
Well, you know, you can learn anything online.
And online,
I had to
watch
a lot of really ugly YouTube videos to learn how to skin a deer. And
is that what you did?
Yes.
How you cheat. If you need like to feel like you have firsthand knowledge, nowadays you can go and just like watch somebody do it and really pick up a lot. But it used to be we all had to go do those things or you just make them up, right? You know, Howard's Conan, a lot of that stuff, you read it now and you're like, nah, he's a great character, but it's completely fiction. It doesn't work at all. You read this and I had no doubts really that Helena was the person you said she was and that she had done all the things that you claimed she had done. It all felt completely practical, completely real. And it flowed so lovely. It was just beautiful to read.
Oh, thank you so much. So it was just a delight for me to write a character who loves the natural world in the Upper Peninsula as much as I do, you know? Yeah. So that was really fun. And I did that again with the Wicked Sister.
So I want to ask though about her father. And how did you come up with this character and how did you give him, because he's not necessarily an evil guy, but he's certainly the bad guy of the book.
I appreciate your saying that because, you know, he's a bad man who has done bad things, not in his mind, you know? And so part of the job of an author, even though he doesn't have a point of view in the book, I still have to know him. I still have to understand him. I have to know why he does the things that he does. And so, you know, when there are scenes, when I write scenes that involve Helena's father character, Jacob, I'm in his head. I'm him, you know, that's how it works. And so, in the Upper Peninsula, it's such an interesting place. My husband and I lived there for 30 years, not in that little cabin, but, you know, we were in the UP for 30 years. And they're a very different kind of people, you know, self-reliant, self-sufficient, very kind and generous to other people. If you break down alongside the road, you know, 10 cars are going to stop in 2 minutes because, you know, that's how they are. But I've known those mountain man types too, you know? Yeah. And so that's sort of what I patterned Jacob after that. I also had dealings with a narcissist in a professional setting for several years. And so I felt like I could pretty accurately write that too.
Oh, that's excellent, because I can see that. Like, you're talking about the UP, you know, mountain men, and those guys are a really hardy breed, and they're very individualistic, but they don't tend to be narcissistic, per se, and definitely Jacob had that in him.
Yes, he did. He did. And Helena has a little bit of that, too, you know.
A little bit, yep.
That's what she learned, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and it probably would have helped her survive a little bit, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really love the idea that, you know, what we didn't touch on for listeners who haven't read the book is that Helena's growing up years are only half the story. And in the present day part of the story, she's a young mother of two little girls. She's still living in the Upper Peninsula. But when she and her mother left the marsh when Helena was 12, there was a lot of notoriety. And she put up with it till she was about 18. And then she decided she'd had enough. So she took a new name, new identity. You know, now she's married. She has two little girls. Her husband does not know her history because she just wants, you know, a quiet, peaceful life. And her father escapes from the maximum security prison, which is 30 miles from her home. During a prison transfer, he kills two guards and he disappears into the wilderness or the marsh, the swamp. And so in the present day half of the story, Helena has to use the hunting and tracking skills that he taught her when she was a little girl to find him before he can find her. So, you know, there's this cat and mouse game in the present going on. And Helena's, you know, pursuit of her father is conflicted because, you know, he's her father. She still loves him.
Yeah, that was, again, The Marsh King's Daughter. And if you haven't read it, you're missing out. Now we're going to move on to The Wicked Sister, your sophomore novel, which is equally as thrilling. Great follow-up. I was blown away. You owe me a milkshake. And you want to know why?
Because I do want to know why.
The twist. Oh, my God. Sorry, I have to stop putting my hands over my face. But that twist, I had my feet on the coffee table, which my mom always said I shouldn't do growing up. And now I know why. Because that twist, I kicked my foot out and my milkshake went flying.
Well, that's great. I love it.
I love the twist. So for those of you who haven't read The Wicked Sister, The Wicked Sister follows the story of a young girl named Rachel, who's been in a mental institution for 15 years, and she's had this intense trauma happen to her, and it's so intense that she actually has no clear memory of what the incident happened. And for the longest time, she's been told that she murdered her parents. And the story goes on to Rachel and some revelations happen. I don't want to give the story away, and I certainly don't want to give the twist away. But, you know, you sort of drop us into this story at the most exciting time, when Rachel's sort of been in therapy for all these years. And she's sort of, you know, she's got one friend in the mental institution and she's sort of developed this crush on his older brother, who's trying to be a journalist. So she agrees to tell him her story. And in telling the story and in repeating the story, she sort of starts to have almost flashbacks, like just have all these feelings, all these revelations. And so tell us a bit about your process with writing The Wicked Sister. What inspired you to write that book?
Yeah, there are actually two elements. So I'm like a lot of writers. I'll read something in the newspaper and it just strikes a chord with me, and I file it away in my I'm going to use that one day, file. So a lot of years ago, I read it about an incident. It was an accidental shooting, which, those are tragic any way you look at it, especially when they involve children. This one was a toddler was strapped into his car seat behind his mother in the back seat of the car, and he found a loaded handgun in her purse, shot her through the seat, and killed her.
Horrific.
Yep.
And the thing that struck me about that was I couldn't stop thinking about, well, what happens when that little boy grows up? At some point, he's going to find out what he did. It can't be hidden forever. And so, maybe when he's 12 or 15 or 20 or who knows what, he's going to find out. And my questions were, how would that change you? You're going along and you're thinking you're a good person, and then you find out you did this terrible thing, even though you were little and, couldn't be held responsible for it. And so, that's sort of the case with Rachel. Her parents, they die tragically when she's 11. She thinks she's responsible. So she's carrying that huge burden of guilt, which, is massive. And so that's what I'm exploring. What would that do to you? How would that shape you? And then the other half of the story is Rachel's mother's story. Yes. And so the book is told in two parts. I call it Now and Then. Mm-hmm. And so the reader knows from the beginning that, Jenny has died in this tragic accident, but I still write the past and present tense as if it's unfolding. And Jenny's half of the story comes again from personal experience. Obviously there's a wicked sister in the story, right? Rachel has a sister because, of the
title. Titles.
We were getting,
That much we're not doing any spoilers, right?
Yeah, we're trying not to.
Yeah, and so their firstborn child, Jenny and her husband, is a difficult child, really difficult child. And that comes from, again, personal experience. Friends of ours many years ago adopted three siblings. And obviously the kids had issues. They came from a troubled background or they wouldn't have been available for adoption. Mm-hmm. The younger two did really well in the new environment, but the older child did not. And he became more and more difficult, hard to handle, even violent toward his little brother and sister. And when he was 12, the parents had to put him in an institution. Yeah. And I thought, that's like Sophie's Choice. You have to choose the two younger children over the older child. And they loved all three kids by then, So that's the sort of issue that this family is dealing with in the past. They have a difficult child, clear signals that things are not going to end well, but as parents, you wouldn't just throw your child away. You would do everything you could to try to make things work. So that's what's happening in the story in the past.
I was truly sympathetic towards Jenny, who, was struggled with that, with her love for her child, as well as her fear and her resentment.
That's right. Like, I had four children and they were all wonderful, adjusted genius kids, right? Perfect children in every way. Of course.
That's the stories we tell, right?
Child, right?
Yeah. That's my three boys, well-adjusted geniuses.
Absolutely. Yeah, there you go. But if one of them wasn't, then what would you do,
Right,
You'd do everything you could to make it work.
And Karen, you returned to Michigan's UP in this one, right?
Yeah, I did. After The Marsh King's Daughter did so well, my publisher bought two books, even though the next book had not even been conceived yet. Mm-hmm. And so I had a conversation with my editor very early on of what should book two be. And he laid out four criteria that The Wicked Sister, which, the second book should share with The Marsh King's Daughter. It should be another psychological suspense, same or similar setting. It should have a fairy tale element, which The Marsh King's Daughter does, which we haven't even touched on yet. Mm-hmm. And then it should also have an intricate structure. And I was especially pleased that he named those last two because those were the things I was most proud of with The Marsh King's Daughter. Prior to writing The Marsh King's Daughter, I had never written a story that had two timelines, or, you know, and there were just a lot of other writing craft type things that I had to learn to use. I had to try them in order to tell the story that I wanted to tell. So, you know, that became the Wicked Sister then. It fell within those parameters. But of course, I wanted to tell the story in a different way. You know, I didn't want to make a copy of The Marsh King's Daughter. So it shares enough, you know, the setting. And I have to say, my third book that I'm working on now is still also set in the Upper Peninsula. I just love it up there so much.
It's a great setting. Like, a lot of people aren't aware that Michigan kind of is divided into these two different areas. Like, there's Motown, you know, the whole Detroit and everything, and a lot of that area is really built around the automobile industry. And then there's this Upper Peninsula, and which is a wholly different world.
It really is. And, you know, a fact that I found when I was researching for The Marsh King's Daughter, the Upper Peninsula has 29% of the land area of the state of Michigan and 3% of the population.
Right, right.
So, it's a different world. A big, empty place.
Yeah.
A lot of wilderness, a lot of animals. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. I mean, Stephen King, a lot of his books take place in Maine, Derry, Bangor.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So you're just, you know, I think that, you know, in some senses in fiction, we still have to write about what we know.
Yeah. And you can bring an extra layer to it. Like The Marsh King's Daughter was reviewed in the New York Times, which for a writer is just a kill me now moment. It's not
right.
Going to get any better than this. And the reviewer, he singled out two things that made the book, in his words, so superb. And one of them was the authenticity of the setting. And he elaborated on that. And he said, you can tell, you know, when the author describes things having to do with the natural world, that her knowledge goes deeper than Wikipedia.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
And that's why I was so surprised when you said that all your knowledge of the hunting, the fishing, the guns has come through just research. Because I thought, you know, here I pictured you out there in a trapper's hat checking your lines and, you know.
Yeah.
Hauling home a deer.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that I put one over on you.
You've got everybody fooled. I'd love to see your Google history because I even wrote it down. For the Wicked Sister, you would have committing someone into an institution, committing someone over the age of, I guess it would be 21 in America, into an institution, how mental health facilities worked, taxidermy, psychopathy, parents of psychopaths. So
any writer who writes thrillers or suspense has very interesting search history.
Right. It's the kind of history that if anything goes wrong, it's going to be used against you.
Yeah. It was kind of funny too, because as I was working on The Wicked Sister, I started over a few times, and at one point, I was in the airport. I was going to travel out of the country, and my literary agent called, and we needed to discuss some of the plot points, and my flight was delayed, so sure. And then at some point, I realized I was talking about killing people, and I thought, you know, this isn't a good phone call to have in the airport.
In the airport, yes. You suddenly look like an international assassin and nobody wants to be next to you. Oh, that's excellent.
One of the things I also loved about the Wicked Sister is you do sort of have that sort of fairy tale element in this incredibly suspenseful thriller. There's still that sort of supernatural fairy tale element that you gave to Rachel, in where she can speak to the animals and they guide her.
Yeah. Yeah. And so just to fill in for listeners who have not read The Marsh King's Daughter, the third element, I talked about how I woke up in the night with basically the character talking to me.
Yeah.
I set the book at a place that I know well. Well, the third element is the fairy tale element, because when I decided I was going to write Helena's story, I didn't know what that story was going to be. And so at that point, I pulled my childhood books of fairy tales off the shelf. And the reason I did that, well, to see if I could find a fairy tale that I could use to structure the story. And I did that because one of my agent's clients, her name is Eowyn Ivy, and she wrote a book called The Snow Child. It's a beautiful, gorgeous, gorgeous book. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. So, you know, it's an amazing book. And it's set in 1920s Alaska, where Eowyn herself lives and homesteads. But it follows the fairy tale, The Snow Child. And so I started paging through. And when I found the fairy tale, The Marsh King's Daughter, I was just astonished at how well it fit. Because in the fairy tale, the Marsh King's daughter is the daughter of a beautiful Egyptian princess and the evil Marsh King. And my character who came to me in the night is the daughter of an innocent girl and the bad man who kidnapped her. In the fairy tale, it's set, well, in the marsh or the swamp, and I had already set my book there. In the fairy tale, it's set in Viking country, so in the north, and I had set my story in Michigan's, you know, northern area. And the key thing in the fairy tale is by day, the Marsh King's daughter of the fairy tale is beautiful like her mother, but she has her father's wicked, wild temper. And then at night that flips, and she takes on her mother's gentle nature in the guise of a hideous frog. So the fairy tale is all about the struggle of good and bad within us, you know, nature versus nurture and all of that. And so, again, the character who I had conceived was herself genetically half her mother, half her father. So which way is she going to turn out? So I used the events of the fairy tale to structure the story set in the past of the Marsh King's daughter. Now coming forward to the Wicked Sister, I initially looked to see if there was a fairy tale that might speak to me in the same way that I could use to structure the story, but none did, no single fairy tale. And so I thought, well, maybe I can kind of make the whole book feel a little bit like a fairy tale. So the story takes place at a beautiful over-the-top hunting lodge in the middle of this dense, dense forest. That's like the castle in the forest, right, from fairy tales. And there's a rivalry between sisters, which, you know, shows up in stories like Cinderella and her stepsisters. And then, yes, there is the talking to animals element, because all fairy tales have talking animals, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so that was my goal, and I'm really happy to hear that you picked up on that.
Oh, I absolutely loved it, but you just blew me away. So you actually found the fairy tale, The Marsh King's Daughter, after you'd written the book.
I did, and of course, people logically conclude that I was inspired by the fairy tale to write
the other way around. Yeah, yeah,
yes. The other way around. Yeah,
that's incredible.
Yeah, it is.
Do you think you were just lucky in that, or do you think that there, like, you knew the story before, but you know it wasn't forefront in your conscious mind when you were writing?
No, it wasn't. And, you know, and obviously I had read that fairy tale, you know, but it wasn't until I started paging through and found it that I realized how well it fit the story that I'd already conceived. And I think that's, you know, it's so interesting. Where does inspiration come from? You know, it's the sum total of everything we've seen and heard and thought, but it comes out in fresh ways, unexpected ways. And so it was definitely a really special experience. And so when I found the fairy tale, that was about day five after, you know, I got the idea for the book. And I knew at that point that this book could be something really special. So at that point, my husband and I, we were self-employed all our lives. We never had much in a financial way because of our lifestyle choices when we were young. And so we were doing furniture upholstery in a workshop behind our home. So I worked on the novel full time for a year, basically on spec, but I knew that it had the potential to do really well for us. And at the end of the year, when the book was done and my agent sent it out to editors to see if anyone wanted to buy the book, actually 12 publishers wanted to buy and publish.
Oh my gosh, Karen.
I know. So you know, we had what's like a 12-way auction, you know, for and that was just for North American rights. So immediately after The Marsh King's Daughter sold in a 7-way auction in the UK, a 5-way auction in Germany, a 3-way auction in Korea, for a record amount in Poland, and it just kept going like that. As you say, it ended up, it's been translated into 20, 25 languages around the world.
Yeah.
Wow. And it was a bestseller in Germany and Sweden and Iceland. And The Wicked Sister just hit the bestseller list in Germany. Yay!
Congratulations.
So you're going to owe a lot of milkshakes at the end of this. That twist is just, I just can't even get over it. Wow. I think.
Thank you, Kari. That's so cool.
You're welcome. No, it's so cool to talk to the person that, that wrote it, because it just blew me away. I didn't see it coming, but then when it came, it made perfect sense. You know,
that's very cool,
because like the rising, I mean, you've really nailed that whole rising tension, rising conflict, you know, that they can teach in university as much as they want to, but you know, it takes a special kind of writer to really pull it off. So you've done that, and yeah, that was, I love that book.
Well, and you know, that first book that I mentioned that my agent signed with, it was the plotting and the pace and the momentum that was such a mess. So, you know, you can learn as you go along.
Well, practice, right? It's just like anything else. It's just learning the trumpet or the hula hoop, you know, it's just the more you keep at it, you've done, you know, you put in 20 years worth.
Yeah. And the other thing, if there are aspiring writers listening, you know, so my two takeaways that I hope writers take from my experience, the first one is don't quit, you know, because mm-hmm. it took several books and quite a few years before mm-hmm. I had this breakout book. And then the other is don't be afraid to try something new, because I've already touched on this, how in order to write The Marsh King's Daughter, I had to try a lot of writing techniques that I had never used before. Directly addressing the reader. You know, if I told you my mother's name, you'd recognize it. I'd never done that. The dual timeline, there are a lot of flashbacks, there are tense shifts. Three quarters of the way through the book, some imaginary characters show up. I'd never written imaginary characters before. And then, you know, how was I going to incorporate the fairy tale element? All these things made... There were times when I was so unsure, I felt so far outside my comfort zone, and I wasn't even sure if the book was working. And to be honest, when I sent the first chapter to my agent, I had no idea if I'd written anything that was any good or not. Mm-hmm. And he came back and said, yeah, it was wonderful. He told me very much later, it was so good, he did not think I had written it.
Oh.
Wow.
That's not a burn. You know, I mean, that's just a fact.
That's great, though.
That's how far you had come. That's so exciting that, and that's, I think that's a real testament for all, you know, new authors or authors have been at it for 10, 15 years and are still feel like they're struggling, that you can continue to grow in your craft. And the things that you thought were so great, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago, you know, go ahead and put those on the shelf and keep working on the craft. And then you can come back and you can say, it was okay. I could probably do a lot better with this now.
Absolutely.
That's great.
And so that's my advice. Don't be afraid to change things up. You know, if you've been querying for an agent for a few years and nothing's happening, you know, maybe write something different than you have been. Because just because you start writing a particular kind of book, my early books were science-based thrillers, similar to what Michael Crichton writes. They were not psychological suspense. So just because you start writing in a particular kind of book doesn't mean that's where your strengths are, you know, so experiment and try something new. That's my other, you know, big takeaway that I from my own personal experience that I like to share with others.
So like learn to write, like find what you're good at.
Yeah. Basically. Right.
Because it's not going to necessarily be what you want. So this podcast is for writers and readers. And so from a writing aspect, because you have such intricately woven plots, how do you stay organized with that? What is your writing process?
Yeah, so my early novels, I started with plot and then created the characters around the plot. The Marsh King's Daughter, as you know, started with character, and then I had to find a story or the plot for the character. And it's the same with The Wicked Sister. I personally feel like an author's chances of writing a strong story are better if they start with the character. Because, you know, that's why people read. They're interested in the characters. Yeah. Excuse me, I got to take a little sip here.
It's okay.
So I write an outline, but a very sketchy one. It might be 8 pages total, and that's with, you know, single space with a space between paragraphs. And the reason is I like to have the roadmap, and I usually know where the book is going to end, but I like that process of discovery along the way. So, you know, the imaginary characters that I mentioned in The Marsh King's Daughter, that was not in my outline. It's just as I'm writing, I, you know, they kind of appeared and I was like, okay, this is cool. I can use this. And so I like to have a lot of room. So I'm in between a plotter and a pantser when it comes to that.
Okay. And a lot of instinct from the sound. It just mostly like you go on your instinct, because there's some writers who just they'll write an outline and they will rigidly stick to that outline no matter what.
Yeah, I had that experience once, because I in between the science-based thrillers and The Marsh King's Daughter, I wrote a television tie-in novel. It was work for hire, so that means I was paid a flat fee. Not very much. And I don't even own the copyright to it, but because there was not only the publisher involved, but the Hollywood show that it was based on, the studio. So it was Fox Television's show called The Killing. It's on Netflix now.
Yeah,
so
I
was hired to write an original story using those characters. And in that book, I had to have a very detailed outline because, you know, it had to be approved, like I say, by my publisher and also by the studio. And I'm the kind of person that I would just normally write in my outline for the ending and then a bunch of stuff happens, you know, and that wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. So I had this outline. As I was writing the book, I was not happy with the last third. But I thought, well, I have to stick to the outline. But for me, the ending was falling completely flat. I was not happy with it at all. I turned it into my editor, and when I got her comments, she's like, the ending falls completely flat. And I'm like, I know! Because I thought I wasn't allowed to deviate from the outline that had been approved. So, you know, that can be the problem with the outline. Maybe it's not working. Maybe it's not the best. You just have to be ready to go with what's best for the story.
Right, and have that flexibility to change it.
That's right.
You know, because we stand in our own ways. One of the things I loved the best about The Wicked Sister was the bear.
Ah, yes.
The bears. And I was thrilled. I'm from British Columbia. I was thrilled to see that you gave a shout out to the Kermode bears in the forest up here. And your extensive research that you did just with animal behavior in general.
Yeah, well, you know, black bears are Michigan's largest predator, and they are not the fiercest of bears. You know, they're nothing like grizzlies and Kodiaks and those. But I wanted to put them in the story, but I wanted them to be like powerful creature, yes. Creature to be respected, yes. You know, not I didn't want to do a monster bear tearing apart the campground sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
So that was really fun for me. And to research the bear aspect, there is a bear ranch. I mentioned it in the book, but it's real in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. It happens to be the largest bear only rescue facility in the United States. And Mr. Oswald has been, you know, caring for rescue bears for decades. So he has about between 50 and 70 bears. They're in huge enclosures. There's no breeding. Males in one section, females in another, yearlings in another, cubs in another. So I went up there to, I say up because I'm living in the Detroit area now. I went to the Upper Peninsula to visit his bear ranch, and he gave me all kinds of cool insider tips. And one of the things that I learned was that a bear digs a den as big as the bear itself. And for some reason, I was picturing bears hibernating in these big caves. But why would they do that? Their body heat has to heat this big, big space. That makes no sense, right? You know?
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I thought was interesting was that he and his staff work like crazy all summer long to feed all these bears, right? You know, so they collect scraps from schools and hospitals and grocery stores, meat scraps, vegetable scraps, because bears will eat anything.
Yeah.
And then they have them in these white buckets, and they drive into the enclosures on a four-wheeler and dump it out, and the bears come and eat it. But in the winter, they don't have to do anything at all.
No, they hibernate.
all of their bears hibernate.
Yep, they just have to feed them up in the fall. Where I live in British Columbia, we have a lot of bears. I have a bear that comes here all the time. He takes my garbage. He takes a dump on my lawn. Every single, all the time, at least once a week. You know, he ravages my garden. I don't mind. We have a lot of berry bushes, and I have 9 acres, and so he lives in the back, and he has a den out there. And so we went out there once, and we managed to find his den. He had left it. And they do. They have these surprisingly tiny little dens that they squeeze into, and it's almost like a dirt sleeping bag. You know, they just go into these tiny little dugouts that they make.
Oh, and that's so cool. Oh, yeah. I love hearing that. Yeah. And yeah. Right. So Mr. Oswald, I really wanted to go into one of the enclosures with them, you know, when they fed the bears. And he said he brought a friend in once, and the bear just kind of chomped down on her arm. Didn't really break the skin, but, you know, he's like, no, I can't do that. And my reaction to that was, wouldn't that be cool if you had scars on your arm?
A woman after my own heart. After the show, I will send you pictures of me petting a grizzly bear named Billy, who is owned by an animal trainer here. It's sort of a bittersweet story. Billy was orphaned, he never had anybody teach him any skills to live in the wild. So he was, this man owns him, and he trained him, and he has him in the film industry. So a lot of the commercials that you see. So it's bittersweet how I got to meet this bear. But can I tell you, I mean, my dog will take your hand off for a treat. And I was giving him Timbits, and you guys probably don't know what Timbits are because it's a Canadian thing.
I do.
Oh, you did? Okay, there you go. They're donut holes, and he just loves these donut holes. And it's funny because bears, they are very emotional creatures, apparently. And I had no idea. And he was lovely. I'll send you a picture of, and I thought the exact same thing. Everybody was like, are you crazy? Like, what if he's going to take your arm off? And I thought the same thing, Karen, wouldn't that be cool?
I love it. Yeah.
So I really loved the part with all the bears, and I don't want to spoil the story again, for everybody, but I definitely recommend that you pick up the book. So tell us about you. We were talking earlier, you have a project, a forum that you run, a writers and readers group called The Back Room.
Yeah, so here's the thing. The Wicked Sister published on August 4, so right in the middle of the pandemic. Mm. Back when the pandemic first hit, I was thinking, oh, maybe I'll be able to do some real world events. I had two events scheduled for me that were going to be so cool. One, I have always wanted to be part of, and I work organization in Michigan called the National Writers Series. And I had been invited, and they meet at Opera House, old Opera House in downtown Traverse City, you know, 400 seat auditorium. I really wanted to see if I could fill that auditorium. And of course, it didn't happen. I did do the event, which was pretty wonderful, but it was online, right? As everything was. And so I and another writer, Hank Philippi Ryan, we did an event together. And afterwards, we were talking, we were saying how hard it is to do an online event where you do not see the people you're talking to. You can't see your audience, because when you do a talk at a bookstore, you know, you feed off the energy of the audience. And, you know, when somebody asks questions, you look at that person to answer the question. Mm-hmm. But in an online event, you can't do that. That's what's missing. You can't connect directly with your audience. So I had the idea, why not use Zoom breakout rooms? And, you know, divide up the audience. So what we do is we have a panel of four authors and very short introduction. Then all of the audience is broken up into four Zoom breakout rooms. The authors rotate through each room and, you know, the audience stays in the same room for the evening. And so in the smaller rooms with, you know, 20 or so people in them, you can talk face to face. You know, everybody's mics are off and, you know, their video is on if they choose to. We call it the back room. And the URL is thebackroom.org with hyphens between the words. So, you know, the-back-room.org. And it has taken off like crazy. We are so excited. We have so many, you know, wonderful authors who are eager to participate because they love it. They love being able to talk to readers directly. And it's nice for writers, too, because, you know, we're missing the conferences. We can't interact face-to-face at conferences. But here, you know, you can go to the back room and you can talk to people face-to-face. So Samantha Downing and Lori Rader Day are on this Sunday. We have down the line, Lisa Gardner is coming, Lisa Unger, just all kinds of wonderful, mostly thriller writers, but we also have historical fiction and women's fiction and, you know, other groupings too. So, yeah, people, it's free. Check it out. It's a great way to.
It's free?
Yes.
So you just go to the back room and you just sign up, or is there a register?
Yes, you do have to register because we have to limit the number, right?
Right.
You know, can't have the breakout rooms get too big. But yeah, these are free events.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. So you've heard it here first, listeners. That's a great opportunity to talk to some writers and to hear what they have to say. And I love to hear about people's process.
Yeah. And, you know, for us, it's like really satisfying to try a new format. I think that after we're able to meet together again in person and authors are once again able to do events, that something like the back room, some certain online events will continue, because why not? We all know how to use Zoom now.
Yeah.
Karen, amazing. can you give that address again, just real quick?
Yes. It's thebackroom.org.
The back room.
Words and separated by a hyphen. So the backroom.org.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get that link off of you as well. Can you tell us?
You.
We'll get it, and because we'll want to post it, because I'm definitely going to check one out. Can you tell us a bit about what you're writing now?
Oh yeah, sure. So again, I'm still in the Upper Peninsula because I haven't exhausted the story possibilities there yet. The Marsh King's Daughter was in the wetland or the marsh, and The Wicked Sister takes place in the forest. So the book that I'm currently writing now, I'm using Lake Superior as the setting, because people who are not familiar with Michigan might not realize that 4 of the 5 Great Lakes surround the state. You know, we have these oceans of water all the way around us. 3,000 miles of coastline, can you believe it, in the state of Michigan?
Yeah.
And Lake Superior is cool because it's the largest, deepest, coldest, you know, roughest lake of all the lakes. When we lived there, we would go up there many times, you know, to enjoy the water and throw stones in and so forth. So the section of shoreline where my story takes place is often called the graveyard of the Great Lakes, because so many ships have gone down in that area, including the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Mm-hmm.
So that might give a little hint as to some of the story events that I'm dealing with in the new book.
Yeah.
Oh, that's just cruel now.
Like, this is rude.
Shipwrecks and oh my goodness. Yeah. Oh, that's delicious. That's delicious.
Yeah, that's going to be great. And when do you think that book's going to come out?
Well, realistically, it would probably publish maybe in January, February of 2022. You know, because I'm not finished writing it yet. And it takes a year to go through the publication process. So, but fortunately, there are many other good books to read while you're waiting, right?
There's something to look forward to. Mm. Fabulous. Well, I think we're just about out of time, folks. And I want to thank you, Karen. Thank you so much for coming on the show and showing up and being present. There's a lot of admirable work out there. And it's common to have a lot of great books, but what's less common is to be able to connect with the author and your favorite authors. And so we're just so grateful that you came on.
Well, thank you both. You know, this was such a fun conversation. I could do this all night.
Oh, good. Oh, good to know.
You'll come back when your third book is coming out, right?
That sounds great. Let's do it.
Excellent.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Goodwin's Greenhouse Supply and Service, Grow with Goodwin's. And for everybody out there, happy holidays. I know it's been a rough year, but I hope your holidays are filled with warmth and love and light. This is where you say goodnight, Rob.
Goodnight, Rob.
Good night, everybody. Until next time, keep reading.